One of the fundamental problems in every philosophy of history turned out to be the constancy of reality experienced throughout the process of compactness and transition to differentiation. The reality experienced by so-called primitives is not different from that experienced by moderns. What happens between, say, the Neolithicum and the modern age are the events of differentiation. The thinker who became aware of this problem and stated its structure was Aristotle in the first two books of Metaphysics. He understood that his philosophical analysis of reality experience analyzed the same reality that was experienced by the earlier thinkers who on occasion he called theological thinkers, who expressed their experience through the myth, specifically refers to Hesiod and Homer. When the earlier thinkers experience a reality and express it by going back to its origin in Uranus and Gaia, they are in search of the same divine ground of being of which he himself is in search and which he recognizes as the nous. The Philomictos is something like a philosophos, and in his late years he became increasingly fond of the myth as a source of wisdom concerning reality that sometimes may be more comprehensive than the structures in reality differentiated by the philosopher. He understood the relations between experiences and symbolizations on the various levels of compactness and differentiation, which I have categorized as equivalence. By equivalence is meant the recognizable identity of reality experienced on and symbolized on different levels of differentiation. The most important consequence of this insight is the understanding of certain processes in history. When a new differentiation occurs, the area of reality that now has become articulately conscious will be, of course, understood as an area of particular importance. And the overrating of its importance in the joy of discovery may lead to the neglect of other areas of reality that were contained in the earlier compact experience and now are neglected. The most important such event of neglect has, of course, occurred in the modern age with the differentiation of the rationality of the natural sciences. The model of the reason that is operative in physics became so much the model of reason that the more fundamental, existentially fundamental aspects of reason, in the classic sense, constituent of man's humanity, were neglected and are gradually rediscovered in the 20th century under the title of existentialism, which rather obscures than clarifies the structure of reason in existence. A good example of the difficulty in this rediscovery of existential order is the late turning of by Jaspers from the terminology of existence, which he favored earlier in his work, to the terminology of reason, in parentheses Vernunft, because he was horrified by the derailments of existentialism, especially in the case of Sartre. That, however, is not the only major case in the history of mankind. One of the great neglects and eclipses of reality occurred in the wake of Christianity. The pneumatic differentiation that we owe to Christ and to the apostles, and especially to Paul, became, under the title of Revelation, the center of Christian thought. And since Revelation, that is, the differentiated pneumatic structure of existence, had to be something entirely new, constituting an epoch in history, the fact that the pneumatic stratum is of course present also in its compact form. In earlier human thought, was neglected. It became a characteristic part of Christian doctrine that man's reason is natural reason and is such a source of knowledge, while besides this natural reason, there has come into the world the new source of knowledge through revelation. That the Greek thinkers were highly articulate about their consciousness of having received a revelation when they discovered the nous as the ground of being was simply ignored. The theophanic core of classic philosophy is still today rather obscure in general consciousness, thanks to this eclipse by the Christian conception of natural reason. Hence there is a remarkable dearth of investigations into the parallel phenomena of the Greek philosophers' revelation and the Christian prophets and apostles' revelation. So the fact that the word propheta in Christian usage is taken from the language of the Greek poets who knew themselves to be the prophets of the God, in the same sense in which Israelite prophets were the speakers of the gods. Once the parallel of revelation on various levels of compactness is recognized, one can of course develop a vocabulary for speaking of it in adequate terms. One can speak of theophanic events and theophanic experiences in both the noetic and the pneumatic contexts of Greek philosophy and Israelite and Christian revelation. And once the parallel is recognized, one can then ask the question, what is the difference between the noetic theophany of a Plato and the pneumatic theophany of a Paul? That would help considerably both to understand the structure of the philosopher's experience, but it would also force the analyst to determine what exactly is the Christian pneumatic new differentiation that goes beyond the theophanic differentiations of Plato and Aristotle. This task simply has not been undertaken as yet and is obscured by the language of distinguishing between natural reason and revelation. The question is certainly not quite outside the horizon of Christian thinkers. A better mind like Thomas Aquinas was very much aware of the problem. He knew that if Christ was to be the head of all mankind, he had to be a little bit more than the head of the members of a Christian church. Hence he formulated clearly that Christ indeed was the head of all men from the creation of the world to its end. He was, one might say, a true humanist, who knew that Christ had come to every man, and not only to Christians, or perhaps only to theologians. This insight of Thomas, of course, leads into the problem which, as far as I know, no Christian thinker ever dares to touch. How Christ concretely can be the head, say, of the Babylonians of the city-state period, and how the pneumatic presence of his logos expresses itself in the experiences and symbolizations of Babylonians. Here is a vast open field for every philosopher of history who wants to do more than bright talking and is seriously interested in the historical materials. The problem is, of course, in a semi-conscious way, always present in studies in ancient history, the history of symbols, the history of myths, in comparative religion, and so forth, because the mere fact that we are interested in all these materials has, of course, its reason, its motive in our concern with the divine presence in these earlier symbols. But I'm not aware that the historical explorers of these materials would dare confess to the motive of their inquiry and to state it clearly as a concern with the process of differentiation that culminates in the ecumenic age, in the decisive differentiations of consciousness through philosophy, Christ and the apostles. Any attention to this critical period will run into the problem that what happened is the location of the process of differentiation in the mind of man, One's consciousness, or in the Greek terminology, the psyche of man, is understood as the site of the process, the understanding of symbolization from the more compact identification of symbols with the presence of divine reality in the cosmos, to the psyche of man as the site of the divine operation in man. With, of course, its most radical realization of the problem in the Christian concept of incarnation. When consciousness becomes luminous for itself as the site of the divine-human cooperation in the process of differentiating history, not the end of all things has come, as some of the contemporaries of this great event believed. The second coming that would make an end to the structure of this world, expected by Paul and the early Christians in the near future, has not happened until today. Instead, something entirely different has happened. The symbolizations in which the experiences of the psyche, consciousness, its noetic and pneumatic structure, were recognized as symbolizations in the process of history, which to one part is a process in this world, so to another part, it is a theophanic process. Symbols at large move in the position of a secondary realization of insight, beyond which there rises the understanding of man's tension toward the divine ground, which does not find its fulfillment in any truth in this world. This further step of an articulation of a stratum experienced beyond the stratum of noetic and pneumatic divine presence is what later came to be called mysticism. That is, after Pseudo-Dionysius. Of course, the recognition of this stratum as man's relation to an ultimate reality in which he would find his fulfillment beyond the process of reality under its present structural conditions of death is also present before it becomes articulate in the Neoplatonically influenced Christian thinkers of the 5th century. One can very well distinguish, even in Plato, a clear knowledge of relations to a divine reality that lies beyond any revelation of divine reality expressed by his symbols of, for instance, the Demiurge or the Nous as the third god after Kronos and Zeus. Mysticism, understood as the experience and articulation of a stratum in reality that lies structurally beyond the reality in which the theophanies in history and even the theophany of Christ occur, is a stratum that goes through all history as far as we have it recorded literally in literature, and is a very important factor, for instance, in Hindu mysticism,